Support for This Day in Esoteric Political History comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software or just want to know what you could be missing, then you'll need to join the millions of others who have switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable, all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/thisday. That's odoo.com/thisday. Odoo, modern management made simple. Hey everyone, Jody here. We are still taking a bit of an early summer break, running some of our favorite recent episodes. But wait, before you go. Look, we're doing something really cool here that we've wanted to do for a long while. Every once in a while, when we do an episode, we'll get a note from a listener saying, you know, so-and-so other show at Radiotopia did an episode about the same topic. We are, of course, part of Radiotopia, which has all sorts of wonderful shows, and a number of them do touch on history and politics and some of the stuff that we get at in this show. But many of those shows take a different approach. They're more narrative or more essayistic or more soundscapey or whatever. So when I get a note like that, I always go and listen to the way that a fellow show has tackled a story, and I always come away learning something new and thinking how cool it is that a story can be approached in such a variety of ways, and I'm inspired, honestly. So for the next few episodes, what we're going to do is run episodes we've done about a story and then pair that by immediately running another Radiotopia show's approach to the same topic. This is a bit of an experiment, but I think it will make for really cool listening and really interesting pairings, and it will also prove that we are indeed part of a wonderful network of shows and creative, independent radio makers. Okay, I think you get it. We've got a number of these lined up. So first up, an episode we did about a near-miss nuclear disaster in North Carolina, and then we're going to pair it with a story from Radio Diaries about a near-miss nuclear disaster in Arkansas. Here we go. Hello and welcome to This Day in Esoteric Political History from Radiotopia. My name is Jody Avergan. This is one of our most requested episodes that we're about to do. I'm really glad we're getting to it, but here is the incident. Overnight on January 23rd, 1961, in eastern North Carolina, a U.S. Air Force bomber broke in half mid-air. The crew of eight were ordered to abandon the aircraft. Five of them would survive this incident. The plane broke up, came crashing down in a fairly populous area near Goldsboro, North Carolina. Now, what was aboard that aircraft that broke in half and came crashing down over eastern North Carolina? Two MK-39 thermonuclear bombs. These hydrogen bombs were being transported by the airplane, and of course, they too came crashing to the ground as well. While being transported, the nuclear weapons were unarmed, but the investigation in the wake of this crash revealed that as they came crashing to the ground, the bombs had gone through several steps of the arming process, and one of them, in particular, was basically one signal away from detonation. So let's talk about the time in 1961 that the U.S. nearly nuclear bombed itself over in North Carolina. Here to do that, as always, are Nicole Hemmer of Columbia and Kelly Carter Jackson of Wellesley. Hello there.
I have to calm myself down from the anxiety attack I'm having just from the description of this. It's too much.
It's quite remarkable.
Hello, Jody.
Hey there.
Hello. All right, so a quick show of hands among the three of us. Just, is anyone here married to a former transport pilot for the Air Force? Let me see. Okay. Oh, okay. Kelly, you're raising your hands.
Y'all have me, like, I have gone down a rabbit hole with my husband because I should just say, my husband went to the Air Force Academy. He majored in aeronautical engineering. He is currently a pilot. He's been a pilot for, gosh, over, I don't know, 20-something years. He also did his master's thesis in anti-ballistic missile something. Like, he's, sometimes I look at him like, who are you? You know when you find out you're like married to a spy and you're like, who are you? Like, so I asked him if he knew about this crash in North Carolina, and he was like, oh yeah, everybody knows about that. And I was like, really? Everybody knows about that? But apparently, what's even scarier is that this is actually not an anomaly, that they have had lots of crashes, like dozens upon dozens of crashes that have just kind of gone, like, at least under the public radar. And it's astonishing. Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, I think the larger context, of course, in the 50s and 60s is the U.S. is just like very quickly getting into nuclear weapons and obviously transporting this and running experiments and maybe not realizing what it has gotten itself into. Thoughts on that, Nick Geer? Do you want to just talk about the sort of incident here and then we can contextualize about how rare or scary or whatever it actually was?
I just think it's really important to understand that the fact that we made it through the 1950s and 1960s without nuking ourselves is kind of a miracle. If you look at how precarious this all was and how, you know, everyone's just kind of experimenting and trying new ways to cart around nuclear weapons, and they decide they want to do it while carting around nuclear weapons. That they just, they're like, oh, let's try this. Let's get those bombs up on the plane and fly around and see what happens. Seems like a really bad idea, but they were doing it all the time. That something like this not only happened, but happened on the regular, it is a miracle we're all still here.
And I should say, like, part of the context Nathaniel, that's my husband, Nathaniel was giving me was that the capacity was just so crazy. Like, now there's like maybe like 100 or so like bomber jets in the Air Force, but back then there was like over 500. So they were constantly flying all over the place, and they were always armed. Now they don't do, you know, they don't have nuclear weapons on these planes when they're practicing, I should say. But when they were practicing, all of them were armed, and they were all over the world, all of the poles. It was meant to, like, they were like circling the poles. These airplanes would circle so that if at any minute something went down, especially during the Cold War, they could get to Russia relatively quickly.
Right. And so this airplane in 1961, called the Keep 19, which was a Boeing B-52G-95BW, only Kelly's husband will appreciate that, but nonetheless, a Boeing B-52G-95BW Stratofortress with a oh my gosh, with the 424 First Strategic Wing. That was a unit. Anyway, I've seen this reported as a training mission. I've seen this reported, but it is really on an alert mission, and it is off the coast of the Atlantic coast of the United States with these bombs. But basically, because the U.S. is on sort of continual high alert, both doing training missions, but also wants to be in a position to react should there be a nuclear strike. This is the height of the Cold War, of course. And so the notion of a surprise nuclear attack by Russia is not totally out of the question. These bombs, these Mark 39 nuclear bombs, are about 12 feet long. They weigh more than 6,200 pounds. The energy is 3.8 million tons of TNT is the equivalent. We'll talk a little bit about what would have gone wrong had these actually detonated, but maybe a little TikTok on the incident itself. It's during refueling that something goes wrong. There's a fuel leak and the plane starts to break up. I mentioned in the intro, there's an alert to eject, and the crew tries to eject. What else goes down as we know it?
Well, so you mentioned that it's refueling, and Kelly was talking about how these planes were always in the air. So this was one of those 24-hour surveillance alert flights. It's flying up and down the coast. It's going around Greenland, coming back. And it's somewhere in that refueling around Greenland that something happens. They notice that there's fuel coming out of this plane. And so it's trying to do an emergency landing in North Carolina at a nearby Air Force base when it just starts falling apart in the middle of the air, right? It a wing falls off, and so it starts barrel rolling, and then the tail falls off. And as you said, the people inside, there were 8 people on the crew, they eject. And because the plane like cracks in half, it pulls the pulleys that you would pull if you were releasing the bomb. And so the bombs think that they're being launched, not just falling. And these two bombs fall to earth as they're going through their arming sequences, and one of them gets stuck in a tree, as you do, and the other one, they lose the other one. The other one sinks into the mud, and they don't know where it is.
To this day, they don't know where it is.
Terrifying.
I should also say that it does take a lot to set off a nuclear bomb. It's not one of those bombs that will implode upon impact. It's like it's more constructed like a clock, so it requires a certain fuse to detonate it, and there are certain steps that have to go in place. A lot of them, I believe, my husband told me, not one person can just set it off. Like, it takes multiple people in order to, like, really course an H-bomb. So, I mean, that should give us some comfort knowing that it's not just going to like hit the ground and implode. But at the same time, the chemicals that are, you know, involved in these bombs are super toxic. So, you know, there's always the fear of that, the plutonium that's in all of them, you know, it's a lot. But I think that the interesting thing about this is that the United States was more concerned that the bomb dropped in U.S. territory than anything else. Because if it drops in North Carolina, well, then, okay, we don't have to worry about the Soviets, like, coming to get it. But if it drops in the ocean, then it's, like, all bets are off. And that's where you get the film, like, Men of Honor, where they're, like, submarine is going down to retrieve the bomb or whatever.
Right.
That's where that comes from. So location really does matter.
My main concern would have been the nuclear bombs landing just, you know, a couple dozen miles east of Raleigh, North Carolina. That would be my main concern. But, you know, I understand the point you're trying to make.
And as comforting as it is to know that there are all of those steps, they barely hold. I mean, not only do these bombs go through their sequencing, but the final step, there's a kind of a toggle on the bomb that's either on safe or it's on arm. And on one of the bombs, for some reason, it was switched to arm. And it was just like two wires didn't cross. And so it doesn't explode. But the knife's edge on which this unfolds and the difference between what happened, which is essentially nothing happened, and this bomb that has a 17-mile kill radius, like it would have just wiped out anyone who was outside in a 17-mile radius, to prevent that from happening, I mean, it's just a wire.
Yeah.
I don't like that.
And there's a lot of, you know, details about what exactly went wrong and still some sort of speculation about what it was. I mean, but basically, you know, and as we said, you know, one of them, a parachute deployed and it landed in a tree. Another one just hit the ground directly. And that sort of may have been the thing that switched it to arm. But a piece of wiring may have popped off and so forth. Anyway, there's a lot of sort of small little knife's edge moments here, which sort of reminds me of a point we've talked about on the show in general, which is, you know, there's one way to view American history is us just kind of like bouncing back and forth between near disaster, occasionally tipping over into actual disaster. Mm. But it feels like so many of the stories we discuss are just like, wow, you know, just think about what could have happened here.
Yeah.
Do we want to get into that a little bit? You just sort of mentioned it, but, you know, a 17-mile blast radius, again, fairly populous part of the country. And what is the what if here?
Well, the big what if here is, this is in 1961. John Kennedy has just been sworn in as president. The Cold War is as hot as it's ever been because of what's going on in Cuba. This is going to be the site of the Cuban Missile Crisis, the Bay of Pigs disaster. Like, Kennedy has inherited a mess, but it's also one of those moments in a transition of power where you could imagine the Soviets trying to take advantage of this young new president. And so had this bomb landed and gone off, not only would it have been devastating for the people that it killed, the environmental cost, but the U.S. would not have necessarily known that it had bombed itself. It could have interpreted it as an attack from the Soviet Union, and there you go. Then the bombs start flying, and it becomes a catastrophic, if not apocalyptic, disaster.
This is also what, I mean, we refer to as the military-industrial complex, which is the rapid, rapid development of military technology and bombs and missiles. I mean, we get annoyed at how much the iPhone changes, but the way that, like, these planes and these bombs and these missiles are being constantly upgraded, constantly magnified to, you know, create just incredible amounts of harm, it's extraordinary. I mean, when you think about the fact that they usually, I mean, after when they start sort of rolling back the number of planes that they're using because they realize they can use missiles or basically rockets, like, those missiles can get from the U.S. to the Soviet in 12 minutes. 12 minutes. That's if they're in the United States. So imagine if they're on some submarine off the coastline. It's a matter of seconds that they can detonate. And so it should give a lot of people pause about, well, is this necessary? Is this, like, should we be doing this? I mean, there's a lot of ethical questions that have to go into play when thinking about these, not just potential disasters, but, like, why are we even doing this?
major accidents involving a nuclear weapon are called Broken Arrow. That's where that term comes from. The Defense Department has disclosed 32 Broken Arrow incidents between 1950 and 1980. Now, you know, there's a little skepticism.
That's what they
Those
disclosed.
Are the ones they disclosed. Exactly. You know, 21 of these declassified ones have been aircraft-related incidents. But Kelly, to your point, there's all sorts of other incidents that have gone on. You know, these were happening fairly often, and so it's worth paying attention on that front. Mm-hmm. As we wrap up, there's one I've known about this for a while, and I think I've like kind of ended up randomly on the Wikipedia page for the Goldsboro incident a number of times. There is a road sign, a marker for this incident, but if you look at the sign, and we'll post this on Twitter or whatever, because it's like this small sign by the side of the road, and it says nuclear mishap. B-52 transporting two nuclear bombs crashed January 1961. Widespread disaster averted. Three crewmen died. And that's it. That's the sign. And it's just like, you know, we talk all this time about like, well, there should be a plaque about this. It's like, well, sometimes the plaque doesn't really tell the story. This feels like this little sign right here on the side of the road in North
that
Carolina.
That you're going to drive
by. Really? Yep. Doesn't really seem to paint the picture. And it makes me think also of an email we got. As I said, a number of people have recommended this. We got an email from a listener named Sam Taylor who grew up in this area. And he says that he often thinks about this event because his father, who would have been 7 around the time, recalls that his grandparents took him and his siblings to see this crash and the unexploded nuclear bombs. And he said that the cars in the neighborhood were backed up for miles to try and drive by and get an eye on the crash site. And he says, you know, that these bombs were about 250 times more powerful than the bomb dropped on Hiroshima. And thousands of people, including his family, would have been, you know, wiped out or at least faced years of radiation poisoning had they actually gone off. But there's a sort of listener who has a sort of first person account of what it must have been like to have this happen in your community.
Yeah. Yeah, it's that combination of both just perilous disaster and interest. Like, if there's an unexploded nuclear bomb hanging from a tree, there is a part of you that kind of wants to go see what it's like.
Up in the car.
That's right. Yeah. Not me. Again, I go back to the ethical questions, right? Like, is this necessary? Like, I mean, overkill, I think, is like an understatement. This is like all that goes into this technology. I mean, it begs a lot of questions.
Yeah. You know, certainly in North Carolina, this part of North Carolina, this is a known incident. There is the small little, there's the stories, and then there's the small little plaque. This incident was generally, I think, hidden or not really covered until, you know, maybe 10 years ago or so. And I think a lot of that is due to Eric Schlosser, fantastic historian and writer who wrote about this in his book, Command and Control. But that wasn't until 2013 or so.
Yeah, and it was made possible by the release of a tranche of documents about this, right? He spent so much time putting in FOIA requests and trying to get this information from the government and the military. So it took a lot of legwork just to get the information of what really happened.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think that is a good way to wrap up the episode. I think we've learned a lot. I think that they should make that plaque a little bigger.
Yeah, a little more information.
Say more. But yeah, this is super fascinating. And yeah, I went and we checked. I think this is 6 times we've gotten emails from folks over the last couple of years saying, hey, we should do this. So I'm glad we finally got around to this one. Nicole Hemmer, thanks to you.
Thank you, Jody.
And Kelly Carter Jackson, thanks to you. And thanks to your connections to a U.S. Air Force expert.
Thanks to Nate. My pleasure. Exactly.
So that was our story, one of our recent favorites. Now a story from Radio Diaries, which is the legendary radio show and podcast that since the mid-90s has been helping people tell their own stories. It's one of my favorite shows, and this is, no joke, one of my favorite radio pieces of all time. So we're honored to present it here. Here is Radio Diaries with their story of a near-miss nuclear disaster from 1980 in Arkansas. This starts with host Joe Richman.
Back in September 1980, September 18th, Jeff Plum climbed into his pickup and headed toward the nuclear missile silo near a tiny town in Arkansas called Damascus. He was a 19-year-old missile technician, a new trainee, riding with another guy, David Powell, who was showing Plum the ropes.
David Powell was certified. He had done it over and over and over. For me, it was fairly new. So, first time I was in training with David.
Plum was a city kid from near Detroit. He remembers sitting in the truck that day, watching the farms and fields fly by, until eventually the truck slowed, pulled into a gravel road in the middle of nowhere, passed through some woods, and came to a fence. There wasn't much to see, a concrete slab with a handful of radio antennas sticking up out of the ground. Under that concrete slab, though, was a 146-foot silo, like an inverted 14-story building. To get in was a sequence of gates, phones, secret codes, several super secure metal and concrete doors. And then at the bottom of the stairs, you could go two directions. Down one hall was the complex's three-story underground command center, with all the communications equipment and computers and staff. A second hallway led to the missile silo.
I was in awe when I would walk into the silo. When you open up the silo door and you walk in there and look at this, and it sometimes the lighting in there was just right to where it just loomed in the dark like it was a bullet in a chamber ready to go. You know, and it had this like dark black warhead on top, pure destruction at the fingertips of a couple of men.
The missile in the silo that day, the one Jeff Plum is describing, was called the Titan II. At the time, the Titan II was the most powerful nuclear weapon in the American arsenal. One of them, just one, could unleash the same power as all the bombs dropped in World War II, including the atomic bombs, times three. All the bombs in World War II, times three. But besides being America's most powerful nuclear missiles, the Titan IIs were also some of the oldest. One especially dangerous and aging part of the Titan II missile was its fuel system. By 1980, most nuclear weapons had switched to solid fuel. But when the Titan II was developed in the 1960s, nuclear weapons used liquid fuel. Liquid fuel meant that we took a nuclear warhead and we put it on top of two gigantic tanks and filled those tanks with incredibly volatile liquids. One tank was rocket fuel. The other was something called oxidizer. Greg Devlin also worked on the Titan II missiles.
And if they ever meet, typically they're meant to meet inside the motor and then it propels it where it's going. But if they ever meet anywhere before that, you'll instantly have an explosion and a fire. So yes, it is a bomb sitting on a bomb.
But even if you didn't mix these fuels, they were extremely dangerous. The oxidizer on its own was a Class A poison, the most toxic category for any chemical. It could ignite spontaneously if it touched leather, paper, cloth, wood. The fuel could ignite if it touched rust, or even if it didn't touch anything. If there were enough fumes and you waved your hand too fast, it could explode.
So between burns, explosions, fire, between inhalation, if you got it on your skin, it would turn to acid. And we actually had a greater fear of the fuels on board than the warhead itself.
The teams that handled this hazardous stuff were called Propellant Transfer Systems Teams, or PTS teams. Surprisingly young guys, 18, 19, 20 years old. They were known for partying hard, speeding, driving motorcycles. Sometimes they would do this thing where they would put missile fuel in a bucket. Then they would take a ping pong ball, fill it with oxidizer, and toss it in the bucket and watch it blow up, like Mad Max beer pong. These were the teams that David Powell was training Jeff Plum to be a part of. Here's Plum.
We could do anything. That was our mindset. You're invincible and nothing was going to stop us. You know, at 19, I didn't have any fear of things at that point in my life.
So we're in the silo. Jeff Plum and his trainer, David Powell, are ready to get to work on a job that was routine maintenance. One of the missile's fuel tanks was low on pressure, so the job was just to take off something called the dust cap, kind of like a gas cap, but on a nuclear missile. Then they'd have to pump in more liquid, and voila, that was it. Except before they could start,
they had a problem with not being able to get the hydraulic platform to come down.
The hydraulic platform went up and down the side of the missile, like a platform for window washers on a high rise, and it was broken. It's worth knowing these fuel tech jobs, PTS jobs, had actually gotten to be more and more of a grind around this time because the missiles were aging.
Materials were outdated, dilapidated, deformed. Valves leaked. pumps failed. There was a lot of things wrong with the missile silo.
So there was more work to do without more people to do it, which meant PTS guys like Powell and Plum were increasingly overworked and burned out, hustling from one missile to another to patch them up, regularly pulling 12 and 14-hour days. And now Plum and Powell had to wait to do this routine maintenance job in the afternoon of a long day.
We were very anxious to get this job completed. It was a Friday night. We were young, wanting to get back to hang out with our friends and drink beer, you know. So I remember laying around up in the control center, just hanging out with these guys for hours.
Finally, they got word the hydraulic platform was up and running. So boom, green light. Plum and Powell suited up in protective gear, picture the guys who kidnap E.T., and they head down the hall towards the missile silo, ready for action.
And as we were going down the long cableway, we realized we didn't have the torque wrench.
After hours of waiting, Plum and Powell had left this crucial tool, the torque wrench, in their truck all the way up on the surface. It was kind of like forgetting your cell phone in your house, if your house had a bunch of enormous concrete and metal doors and required a secret code to get in. It was a pain in the ass on a long, irritating day. Jeff Plum says personally, he didn't know what to do. He was just learning. And the procedures, they were so meticulously laid out. You had to follow these detailed checklists. You needed the right tools.
The checklist was the Bible, you might want to say. And Air Force regulations required us to go through that checklist and follow everything step by step.
So Plum's like, what do we do? And he looked to David Powell. And Powell said, don't worry. For what they were about to do, there was actually another tool. Not the official one, but he'd used it before. So forget the torque wrench. It'll be fine.
So we grabbed this this ratchet, like you would pull out of your toolbox, but quite larger. If you can picture it, was a monstrous thing because it was about 3 feet long. It had about a 3 foot long handle, and the socket weighed anywhere from 5 to 8 pounds. It was a big socket, so it was a large piece of steel.
Plum looked at this wrench, like a 3 foot Willy Wonka type wrench, and he wasn't so sure about it. And this giant socket wrench, besides being kind of the wrong tool, a huge cumbersome wrong tool, it wasn't in the best shape. The two pieces of the wrench were supposed to click together, but they didn't.
So we had a problem at that point, and so we improvised.
Here's what they did. One guy held a socket over this thing they had to remove, the dust cap. The second guy held the huge handle of the ratchet and turned. Sure enough, the cap screwed right off. It worked. No problem. Great. So Plum hands the socket off to Powell.
And I remember saying to him, you've got this, right? You're okay? You got this? And he said, yeah, I got it. Let go of it. And so I remember releasing it. And I remember seeing it kind of just fall. And it hit the platform, the socket did. And it bounced and it went between the platform and the missile.
Just to make sure you're picturing this, Plum and Powell were working way up in the silo, like window washers on the side of a nuclear missile, on a platform. Attached to the platform was this rubber bumper that was supposed to fit right up against the missile, so there was no gap for things to fall through. But as the Titan II facilities had aged, the rubber bumper didn't fit quite right, and so there was a small gap, a socket-sized gap.
It was like it bounced and it landed perfectly in the gap, you know. It's almost like it was like somebody playing tiddlywinks or something. You know how you would, you know, or one of those them old drinking games where you bounce something and landed into the hole perfect. You know, it was just it bounced and it was gone. I literally watched it fall. We had dropped tools numerous times. It wasn't the first time that we ever dropped a tool and watched it fall. It was common. It just happened that when this socket fell, it went down 70 feet, 80 feet, whatever it was there, and it bounced off the thrust ring that the missile sat on. Just this big, giant, round ring. And when it fell, it picked up maximum speed. It hit the top of that thrust ring and just ricocheted into the side of the missile. I heard it hit. Boom. And the next thing you know, I just seen fuel spraying out. I just looked at it down there. I just looked in awe. I couldn't believe what just happened. The only thing I remember saying to David was, this is not good. This is not good.
There's a hierarchy of not good, and this kind of not good might be at the top. This kind of not good was deadly, skin-melting, highly explosive rocket fuel spraying out of a 100-foot-tall intercontinental ballistic missile. On top of that missile sat the most powerful nuclear warhead in the United States of America.
You know, we didn't know how to respond. We looked at it for, I don't know, at least a minute, trying to figure out what we were going to do about it. And then he contacted the team chief and told him that we had a cloud of vapor emitting from the missile.
On the other end of the radio was the missile complex's command center, a 3-story underground bunker filled with monitoring equipment, control panels, and a team staffing all of it. On that team was a guy named Alan Childers. Unlike the PTS teams, Childers was an officer, and he didn't just know a few specifics or mechanics of the Titan II. Alan Childers knew the missile inside and out. He'd spent 6 months studying it, reading a manual called the Dash 1, which laid out every piece of how the massive weapon worked. He and his crew spent most of their time using detailed checklists, going over all the missile systems one by one. Childers was standing behind a control panel when the call from Powell and Plum came in.
So the first thing we heard was that there was smoke in the launch duct. And, of course, the commander's going, what do you mean? What's going on? And then I heard him say, what do you mean smoke in the launch? And he was going to say duct. But I don't think he ever got the word duct out. As soon as that happened, the light started coming on. And it's a klaxon alarm. And it's just, wah, real loud. And all of the lights came on. So you're trained to punch the alarm off once it gets your attention, which it did. You turn the alarm off. Well, the alarm would turn off, but it would immediately come back on again as another light came on. And so these indicator lights were oxidizer in the launch duct, fuel vapors in the launch duct, fire in the launch duct.
Horns and klaxons were going off, sirens. Pretty much every light on the instrument panel, they were lit up.
Just moments later, Plum and Powell had made their way from the silo back to the command center. When they got there, they found a huge scramble, everyone besides them trying to figure out what the problem was.
They were trying to figure out how to deal with all these problems. They were resetting klaxons, and they didn't know what was going on. It was chaos, because they didn't know.
To be clear, faced with the fuel gushing out of the missile, and now the command center firing questions at them, Dave Powell made a choice. It was the kind of choice you make when you're afraid of getting in trouble. He played dumb. He told them there was smoke in the silo, but nothing about the hole they had punched in the missile. Jeff Plum made his own version of that decision, which was to keep quiet and follow Powell's lead. That created a crucial knowledge gap in the room. On the other side of that gap, Alan Childers and the rest of the command staff were left to scramble desperately, frantic to figure out what was wrong. All of that mattered because if all the fuel leaked out, it's not like the missile would just sit there empty. The Titan II's fuel tanks were pressurized, like a tire. And if enough fuel leaked out, it would go flat. Or in the missile's case, it would collapse under its own weight. Enough oxidizer and fuel to carry a 330,000-pound missile across the ocean would smash together underneath the nuclear warhead.
I just, in my own mind, I pictured poking a hole in a pop can. And so all this pressure now is turning to a negative PSI, which internally, I thought it's going to collapse. This tank is going to collapse in on itself. It's sucking itself in. I was scared. I was really concerned that this thing could blow up any moment. So my concern was to get out of there. I didn't know the safety of that warhead.
There were so many questions. How fast was the fuel leaking? When could the missile collapse? Could the silo contain the explosion? Could an explosion set off the nuclear warhead? Minute by minute by minute, Plum stood silent, unsure what to do.
So I just I kind of kept my mouth shut. You know, I didn't answer. David was the one answering the questions.
So they never told us what had happened.
With Plum and Powell holding out, Alan Childers and the team in the command center was slowly running out of options.
We ran all of our, what we called our red tab checklist, our hazard checklist, and it didn't stop anything from happening. All the indicator lights stayed on. That's when the commander turned back to the team and said, "What do you think it is? These indicators don't make any sense." And this was a half hour into it. They said, "We don't know. We don't know what's going on out there. All we saw was the smoke in a launch duct."
Eventually, a guy from the command center team, Rodney Holder, turned to Plum and Powell.
And Rodney asked him again, "What happened? What did you guys? What do you guys know that we don't know?" And Airman Powell started crying. And that's when the commander went. He said, "You need to tell us what is going on out there. We cannot figure it out." And that's when, as he was crying, he basically said, "I dropped the socket off the end of the wrench and it punched a hole in the side of the missile." And the commander just, I could still picture his face. He just turned white. And he said, "You need to tell the command post what you did, because they're going to have questions and I don't want to be relaying it." So he handed him the phone. He brought him over to the console. He said, "I'm going to put Airman Powell on. We have a serious emergency. We just found out what's going on, and I want him to talk to you." And he put him on, and he told him, I don't know how he got it out, because he was crying so much. You know, I just remember everybody standing there watching, just dumbfounded. We're talking about a socket that was bigger than your fist punching a hole in the side of a missile. You couldn't patch it if you wanted to. And by then, so much had drained out, you couldn't even open up the door and lean inside without it eating up your suit. So you couldn't do anything about it by then. And then the commander got back on the phone, and we were basically told to stand by. And we stood by.
As news of what had happened traveled up the Air Force chain of command, everyone at the missile site was instructed to wait. To wait, of course, mind you, inside a nuclear missile complex teetering on the brink of a massive explosion. Just sit tight. Quite a bit of time went by like that. A couple of hours, actually. One of the main questions was whether to keep the missile teams underground, try to somehow fix the leak. Or is it bound to blow up and you should get everyone out? Run like hell and hope the nuclear warhead doesn't go off? Or, maybe a surprising question, is the command center actually the safest place for them?
The launch control center, control room was supposed to survive a nuclear explosion.
Eventually, it was a colonel named John Moser, back at the Air Force Base in Little Rock, who made the decision. He knew the command center was designed to survive a nuclear attack, like a direct hit from a Russian nuclear missile. But how could he be sure? Nothing like this had ever happened before. They were off the map.
For you giving the order, was it a clear call, or were you conflicted? Were you unsure?
I was not unsure. I was a straight-up clear order to evacuate because I didn't want people to be injured. We had no idea what was going to happen. We've never had an explosion or a potential explosion like this. It's never happened before, and I gave the order to evacuate.
And I tried to talk him out of that.
Alan Childers, back in the underground command center, disagreed with Moser's decision. He argued,
I didn't think it'd blow up. And if it did blow up, I thought that the door and the complex would contain the explosion. It was underground, had this cap on it. I had two blast doors protecting me that were the size of bank vault doors, and I was sitting in a facility that was designed to survive a detonation from a Russian nuclear weapon. So I thought, we're safer down here than if we go up above.
I guess I would think, you know, most people would be happy to get an order to say, get out of there.
I felt devastated. Yeah, I was devastated that I had to leave. Even to this day, it bothers me that I had to leave. Never in the history of an active missile complex had you left the missile with a warhead on it, walked away from the site, with the site still running. On principle, I didn't like it. The logic of it made no sense to me. I could not believe that we were leaving that complex. As in desperate shape as that site was, to leave that and not be able to tell people what was occurring out there in that launch duct, even if we couldn't do anything, I felt like there was probably somebody was going to come up with something that we could do, and we would not be there to do it.
Alan Chowders made his case. He knew the Titan II missile inside and out. He knew the dangers, what could happen. He was staring at the United States on the brink of maybe setting off its most powerful nuclear missile, right in the heart of the country. He clung to any hope to do something, anything, to claw the situation back. But Chowders wasn't in charge, and eventually orders came down, and Alan Chowders and everyone else in the Damascus missile complex evacuated. With the benefit of hindsight, we can say that from this point forward, at every point in this story, when the Air Force made a decision, it arguably made the wrong decision. Here, the Air Force ordered them to abandon post. The order was to evacuate through the complex's escape hatch, which had never been used before. It was a narrow tunnel that led to a ladder, which took them several stories back up to the surface. Greg Devlin was above ground with a bunch of backup teams from the Little Rock Air Force Base.
It was just really eerie that night. You know, you saw smoke coming out of the vents over here. You could get whiffs of fuel, hydrazine, which has like a fish type of an odor to it. So you could smell that. So it was a very hazy, eerie looking scenario.
And then with everyone on the surface, it seems the Air Force realized what Alan Chowders had been arguing all along. That the best shot at defusing this crisis, the only way to know what was up in the silo, was to have people inside. So, you guessed it, they ordered two people to go back in. Again here, the Air Force zigged when it should have zagged. The order was not to go in the open escape hatch, which everyone had just come out of. Instead, they told the folks on site they should break in through the front doors of the missile complex. With precious time ticking away, don't go through the back door, which is sitting wide open. No, break through the front door of one of the U.S. military's most secure facilities. Or front doors is more like it. Huge concrete and secure metal doors, using only these tools: a crowbar, a hammer, a long screwdriver, a bolt cutter, and a hydraulic hand pump. It's worth also mentioning, had Alan Chowders stayed in the command center like he wanted to, he could have opened all those doors with a push of a button. People on the site were frustrated and confused, but they followed orders and started burrowing back into the missile complex.
The first two guys to go in were myself and Rex Huckel. We suited up.
Devlin and his partner strapped on oxygen tanks to wade through clouds of lethal rocket fuel. They broke through several doors, and then after 30 minutes, a second two-person team went in to relieve them. And not just any team. One of this duo was David Livingston. Livingston was a member of the PTS team. He was also David Powell's roommate. Powell, who dropped the socket that started the whole thing. Livingston was actually Powell's best friend. They made it all the way to the blast lock door, where there was a meter that took readings of fuel present in the air in the silo.
And at 18,000 parts per million, it's explosion ready. It's ready to explode. That's red line, that's pegged out. So when he called back and said, this thing's about to blow, and the command center said, come back now. So him and Dave Livingston traversed back up the flights of step. They got just above ground, and within 30 seconds, an explosion happened.
It was about 3 o'clock in the morning, and I was standing up, listening to a conversation. And all of a sudden, I lost communications.
This is Colonel John Moser again, who was 50 miles away at the Little Rock Air Force Base calling the shots. The moment of the explosion, he was talking to people on the site, and the line went dead.
All you've ever read is when you have a nuclear explosion, you lose communications for some time, and we lost the communications, and I just had no idea if the blast wave was going to eventually hit Little Rock Air Force Base. I had no idea. I had no idea what was going to happen. So I thought we lost the whole works out there, everybody. And, you know, I'm not a really religious guy, but I almost dropped on my knees to say a quick prayer.
While John Moser was at the Little Rock Air Force Base, waiting for everything around him to be swept off the earth by a nuclear explosion, Alan Childers was back at the Damascus missile site.
It's so hard to describe an explosion like that. The only thing you see is this huge, nighttime turned into day. It was unbelievable because it was so bright all of a sudden. And I literally turned to one of the guys, and I was feeling my chest, and I said, it couldn't be a nuclear explosion because we're still here. And that's what dawned on me. We were still there.
Man, oh my gosh. I was standing at the fence, and I was facing the silo when it exploded.
Again, Greg Devlin, one of the guys on the first team to go back in, and who was watching as the second team worked.
It was just a bang, the loud sound, and the concussion of wind. It was just, it's like bang! It was like being in front of picture yourself as nothing's there, but you just got hit by a Mack truck.
And all of a sudden, rocks started falling. It was like rain falling. And it was all this gravel from the complex. And metal started falling out of the sky. And everybody started to run.
The chunks of concrete that were landing everywhere were as big as coffee tables. The real big ones were as big as pickup trucks and school buses and stuff like that. These were everywhere. You could hear them hitting the ground around me, man. It was like, boom, boom, boom. I got up immediately. I took off running. I got 5 steps away and a chunk of concrete hit the ground behind me as big as bigger than a school bus.
The trees were on fire. The grass was on fire. The only light we had was fires. And you could see the shadows of just about everything because there was so much fire around there. It was like being in this forest fire without a forest being around you.
And then for just a second or two, it was this one point in time where there was no sound at all. It was like a total calm peace, kind of like the end of the world, for 10 seconds. And then you heard all the screaming and crying and guys yelling, oh my God, I'm hurt, oh, you know.
This is the CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite.
Good evening. Modern age terror swept an area of rural Arkansas today when fuel exploded around a nuclear warhead in a missile silo. The incident began when officials say a workman dropped a wrench.
The morning after, everyone was trying to sort out what had happened. The press, Air Force, local law enforcement, the public. Simply put, the fuel exploded. The nuke didn't go off. The Air Force was keeping tight-lipped, refusing to confirm whether there had even been a nuclear warhead on site. For the survivors, the injuries were extensive. Greg Devlin had burns on his face, neck, and back. His skin was burned off his left hand. Others had extensive burns and broken bones. One airman, David Livingston, was dead. Remember, Livingston was David Powell's roommate and best friend. Livingston was on the second team to go back in, and he was standing just outside the silo when it blew. All that meant Powell had kind of dropped the socket into some huge Rube Goldberg machine of bad luck, and indirectly killed his best friend. At the missile site, the damage was staggering, a monument to just how dangerous the situation had been. The missile silo's door, a 1.5 million pound slab of concrete and steel, had blown off, spun like a frisbee, and landed more than 500 feet away. And then there was the biggest question. Where was the nuclear warhead?
The warhead ended up about a quarter mile away, intact, in a ditch. To me, that's amazing.
As for the question of whether the nuclear warhead could have gone off, the military would later say, no, impossible. There were too many safety measures in place. But lots of people who are familiar with nuclear weapons, who know them well, who worked on the Titan II, they say it absolutely could have. If the warhead had gone off, it's estimated the fallout could have reached more than 400 miles and killed people in Arkansas, Missouri, Kentucky, Illinois, and Indiana. After Damascus, the Air Force officially blamed the incident on human error. So Jeff Plum and David Powell, who dropped the socket. That never sat well with many of the people who were there, who worked at Damascus, including Jeff Plum.
It wasn't uncommon for that to happen. Every guy that worked in those silos, I know, dropped a wrench or a tool at some point in his career. Every guy. And if they tell you they didn't, they're lying. Because there was no way to get around that. It just happened that one went the wrong way.
Plum says the Air Force knew that. They knew then, and they know now, that even when the stakes are nuclear weapons, human error is a factor. After Damascus, workers were required to tie tools to their bodies. One solution to the problem of human error? The lanyard. We should say we asked David Powell to talk about all this, but he didn't want to talk about it. We did learn that he only recently told his wife and family. He'd kept it secret for years and years. Jeff Plum says he thinks Powell really struggled with it, just like he did too. After the incident, Jeff Plum had an episode where he snapped, lost it, and started throwing beer bottles against the wall in a room at the Air Force base. It was bad. The Air Force demoted him, and things went downhill from there. He was eventually discharged from the Air Force. Even now, years later, he finds the accident hard to talk about.
I'll tell the story, and I'll begin to tell the story to someone, and then you just get caught up in it. You tell that story over, I've told it I don't know how many times, you know, and relived it a few times, you know, and I think I think I've had enough, you know. Yeah, just thinking back on it, you know, it wasn't a very good time in my life at that point. So I think I really don't want to tell the story anymore. So, this will be the last time. Yeah, this will be the last time.
One of the remarkable things about Damascus is actually how unremarkable it was. How many accidents there have been like this one. When it comes to nuclear weapons, it's so easy to assume that everything is all taken care of. Oversight is airtight. Precautions and protocols are in place. The stakes are so serious. But the 70-year history of our nuclear weapons is littered with accidents like what happened in Arkansas. Military records show two kinds of mishaps with nuclear weapons: bent spears and broken arrows. Broken's more serious. The explosion at Damascus was a broken arrow. And there have been dozens of other broken arrow incidents. Dozens. Consider these. 1958, there was one where a nuclear bomb was accidentally dropped out of a B-47 flying over South Carolina. It fell 15,000 feet before landing on the property of a guy named Walter Gregg. No one died, the warhead wasn't armed, but the conventional explosive went off, destroying Gregg's home and leaving a 50-foot hole in the ground. 1961, a B-52 over North Carolina accidentally dropped two thermonuclear bombs. Each one 250 times as powerful as the bomb dropped in Hiroshima, and they just fell out over North Carolina. According to the Pentagon, on one of those bombs, five of the six safety switches failed, meaning just one switch prevented this bomb, 250 times as powerful as the Hiroshima bomb, from blowing up part of North Carolina. Altogether, the Pentagon has declassified information about 32 broken arrow incidents, though those records only go up to 1980. So the last official broken arrow that we know about is the missile that exploded in Damascus, Arkansas, when Jeff Plum and Dave Powell dropped a tool. Everything after that is classified. We still have 4,000-some nuclear weapons all around the world. An accident like Damascus could never happen again because our missiles no longer use liquid fuels. So that risk is gone. But there are other risks. There are new ones. Enemies hacking into missile systems over the internet, low morale and other personnel issues among the people who maintain and operate our nuclear arsenal, and aging facilities and technology. I talked to half a dozen experts who are familiar with our nuclear weapons, from places like Yale, Berkeley, Harvard, and former military officials. They worry about mishaps and accidents that most of us never consider,
with weapons most of us never think about. All of them pointed out the accident at Damascus. No one saw that coming. There were supposed to be safeguards to prevent that from ever happening. One military expert said, "The kind of accident we should worry about is the kind that seems impossible." Like what happened in Damascus. Again, Greg Devlin.
One drop socket that A should have, let's just say, not dropped. B should have never got past the platform. C shouldn't have hit the thrust mount. D shouldn't have hit the missile. If it hit it, shouldn't have punctured a hole in it. I mean, there are so many things that shouldn't have happened. But one drop socket wiped out an entire nuclear missile system. One drop socket, 9-pound socket, took it all out. There's no one that thought that scenario out.
A single dropped tool setting off the explosion of a nuclear missile. Greg Devlin says he would have put the chance of that at zero.
All right, that's from Radio Diaries. Thanks to Joe and Nelly and the whole team over there. Brilliant piece. No surprise, Radio Diaries has done a bunch of stories that we've done as well. They did the Kerner Commission, the polio vaccine. They told a story about the Tulsa Massacre. So check those out or just check out all of their amazing work. They recently did a stunning piece about the last person to ever be infected with smallpox. So yeah, check out Radio Diaries. We are proud to be part of Radiotopia alongside them. Okay. I like that experiment. This was very fun. And we're going to do more of these pairings soon with other Radiotopia shows. I will leave it as a surprise, but there are some cool things coming up. Let us know what you think about this pairing and this idea. Email thisdaypod@gmail.com. Subscribe to the newsletter. Find us on social at thisdaypod. My name is Jody Avergan. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you soon.
Radiotopia.